so why don't you guys buckle up and join the ride, because we are going to have some fun going green.
And Abby said, you shouldn't commit illegal acts, except perhaps at night and with your parents' permission.
Your advice is making less sense than usual.
Well, the important thing is family and friendship, honesty, values, and no one got arrested.
You see this jerk? This is the same thing. Kropotkin was the same jerk, and Bakunin was the same jerk. Not good. Not good, I'm telling you.
He was a very good dancer.
He's a lowlife.
George Orwell, who definitely didn't like socialism of any kind, warned us against this. He wrote books that said that totalitarianism is bad and that sticking with old ideas is good.
I got news for you. You gotcha. The general population again.
I did not know that.
I never thought you'd lose a Stalin debate.
You never expect to walk into one.
Sure.
Avoid Marxism. Or telling her you're a Trotskyite.
Trotskyist. Only Stalinists would call the Trotskyist a Trotskyite. And I'm not a Trotskyist anymore. I'm a Maoist.
Relentlessly anti-Trump and relentlessly pro somebody like Obama.
I'm not pro-Obama. I've been a critic of Obama. I'm a critic of the Democratic Party.
Because I'm literally a communist.
Well, you know how it is. The main thing is to get those juicy likes and subscribes. And we can get some more of that sweet, sweet communist money rolling in. You know how it is, bro. Gotta get the communist dollar. Gotta make it to the top.
Just imagine somebody saying under cannibalism or under slavery or under dictatorship, well, there's nothing you can do about it. Well, they'd be wrong. There is something you can do about it. You can get beyond these archaic systems and move closer and closer to fulfilling human capacities. And that's what we need to do.
Welcome, welcome to this live edition of the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, doing a left-wing political talk show for the curious or the committed, talking about the issues and gunning for a post-capitalist future. Because unless you are looking to be beyond our terrible, unjust system, you are mostly left with impotent rage. I have many, many, many environmental stories racked up. I also have many other non-environmental stories, but this is going to be an environmental show. Ecology, the green, and the three lefts. A green flag, a red flag, a black flag. Definitely need some optimism. As usual, a lot of stories that are interconnected or that can be connected together, either by the theme of that they are environmentally aligned or focused. But more so, I pick them, and I'm like, oh, is this one good for the show? Is this one not? Based on, does it push for the narrative I want to get across that we as Americans need to start being joiners? I think what really handicaps people, disempowers, alienates us, feeling less of a person, is that we don't see ourselves as joiners. Now, maybe it's a muscle. We got to practice it. So before joining something political... And what do I mean by Americans aren't joiners? We don't like joining parties. And I'm talking about, you know, the masses. I'm talking about the working class here. I'm not talking about the educated, the middle class, those that are comfortable. They can join things. But usually even they don't. It's always a minority. And thus a minority is who's governing. And that's not democracy. Not at all. So in order to have democracy, to have justice, to have fairness, the things... And thus prosperity for all, because you cannot have economic prosperity without shared governance and shared responsibility and shared power. You know, the thing that everyone is rails against, outraged about. We need to be joiners. We need to join political organizations. People don't consider it as an option. They don't know what organization is right for them. Fair enough. But that's something to look into. You have to feel like I need to join something. Now, joining something political is a big ask for if you've never been political before. You weren't taught to be political, what have you. So start with a book club. Start with something like a neighborhood little get-together or something that, like, you know, feels kind of put in the activism category, like picking up trash. It feels good when you're doing it or maybe when you're done. But then you also kind of feel like this did not make a long-term impact. You know, in a month or so, the trash will be back. We need to go to the trash at its source. What's the source of the trash? So then you're thinking about the big picture. That's kind of what needs to happen. At least that's what I'm told. Like, Dan, you think about the big picture. That's why, you know, that's why I'm a joiner. And also I was brought up with the idea that one can join a political action group or a cause of any kind, because there's plenty of people who are sympathetic to progressive politics, sympathetic to left-wing ideas, sympathetic to the cause or justice, but they won't join. And I'm telling you, straight up, we do not need sympathizers. We need joiners. You know, we do not need people on the sidelines. We need participants. Join the game. I opened the show with the call to action instead of ending it because I don't have any gas in the tank by the time I get to the end, energy-wise. Speaking of energy, so I'm going to start with two stories that illustrate the problem. So I got two stories. One is, so if you remember a few years back, I don't know, maybe it was a meme, maybe it passed a lot of people by, but there was a lot of hullabaloo about solar roadways. We'll solve the climate crisis and the energy crisis all in the same time, and we won't have to give up our cars. We'll have solar roadways. And there are some hucksters basically scamming people out of their to invest in them to try solar roadways. And eventually, more legitimate contractors, companies, they basically scammed some municipalities, actual cities and states, to build and test a section of solar roadway. Energy engineer who is worth anything could see right away, like, solar roadway is a terrible idea. You have to just know a little basics about solar energy. One, it needs to be at a 45-degree angle if it's going to be efficient, effective. So basically, the story is, headline, World's First Solar Road Fails to Meet Expectations. This is by Energy Reporters last month. So here it is, the world's first solar road in Normandy, Northern France, which opened 3 years ago, has failed to meet expectations. It's a kilometer long, about 3 meters wide. A road of solar panels is in part damaged beyond repair and not producing the power that the manufacturer, Wattway, had promised. The panels were worn out by traffic and joints between the panels were shattered. The engineers were accused of not accounting for leaves, shade, dirt, and the weight of tractors that use the road. Storms also blew its circuits. The horizontal position of the cells, meaning the panels, on the road makes them also less efficient than those tilted towards the sun. Wattway originally said the road would power 5,000 homes. Quote, if they really want this to work, they should first stop cars from driving on it, says Mark Jigask of the Network for Energy Transition, which promotes renewable energy. Politicians rushed the project into operation because of the hullabaloo I mentioned to Lviv-au-Pradish near Aiglon without studying its cost effectiveness. The activist expert told the media, it confirms the total absurdity of going all out for innovation to the detriment of solutions that already exist and are more profitable, such as solar panels on roofs. He was quoted in Le Monde, French newspaper. The authorities provided $5 million for the project, and the solar road was inaugurated in 2016 by Céline Royal, then environment minister and the former partner of ex-president François Hollande. She promised a 1,000-kilometer network of solar-powered highways. So futuristic, right? Wrong. The state investment would have helped to subsidize numerous cheap rooftop panels across France. So that's more of the what else could have you done with that money. The country road was intended to produce 790 kilowatt hours per day, but the surface created so much noise that a 70 kilometer speed limit was imposed. The meager output of the road matches challenges faced by less high profile experiments in solar roadways elsewhere, meaning this isn't just a single case. The Normandy road was forecast to produce 790 kilowatts per day, but the first year's energy production was half of that, with less than 150,000 kilowatt hours that year. In the first half of that year, the road generated about 40,000. It was supposed to raise about 10,000 euros a year in sales, but it only yielded 3,000 euros. The strength needed to handle traffic makes them more expensive than conventional panels, and without the air that circulates around roofs, they tend to overheat. A 1 kilometer stretch of photovoltaic highway in China was also abandoned in 2017 when it was stolen by thieves. Wattway conceded that technological changes were needed. We'll innovate our way out of this so-called engineering problem. Our system is not mature for interurban traffic. Oh, right, so it's solar roadways, but only in rural areas. Railway 1's about Wattway runs about 40 similar solar roads, but they're all smaller in scale than the stretch in Normandy. And they probably all underperform, too. But this one was probably financed by just the state, so yeah, so it's news. So why did I share that? I just want to share that there are these purported technological fixes for climate change that we could just innovate our way out. If you listen to Democratic Party candidates, they'll say, innovation, we innovate our way out of a climate crisis. We don't need to use less. We don't need to be more efficient, although efficiency is always kind of brandied about. But also, we can just produce more energy. We can have solar roads, things that look futuristic but are in fact just illusions. They're a lie. It's something that can never happen. Not just because we can't imagine it, but it's just engineeringly impossible. And there's just better things to do. It's not just naysaying, it's saying this is a distraction and we should just fund more rooftop solar or even renewables that do not require the rare earth minerals that solar and wind power currently takes up as an industrial scale process that is also harmful to the environment overall. Next story, small scale, person by person, individualizing a problem and putting it on like individual people to do things like recycle. This is from Out, which is, I guess, more of a tabloid kind of blog, because it's definitely more of a tabloid story, and it'll probably only take me 5 minutes to read it. It's headline, title, and it's a joke in itself, so it's a good meme material. Men don't recycle to avoid looking gay, new study says. The earth is literally melting, but no homo. Written by Fran Toredo, August 5th. Is there anything toxic masculinity can't do? Protect the ozone, apparently. New research has found that one of the deterrents for growing green among men is a fear of their sexual orientation coming under question, according to the journal Sex Roles. Researchers found in a previous 2016 study that environmental consciousness fell into perceived ideas of masculinity and femininity, with eco-friendly behavior widely perceived as feminine, mostly because this caring about things and protecting things is apparently just a feminine thing that women can do. As a gender abolitionist, someone who wants to just get rid of this gendered stuff anyway, and that doesn't mean we get rid of sex or sexual differences. Gender is then the consciousness we put on top of sex to say that if you are male, then you don't seem to care as much. You're not as nurturing. You can't be responsible. You can't be a good caretaker, says gender roles. Throw it out. Compost it. So as I continue, in this new study, 960 participants, okay, about 1,000 people, it's a okay sample size, they were asked to evaluate whether fictional characters felt feminine or masculine based on several environmentally friendly activities, such as paying bills online, turning off the air conditioner, caulking windows, recycling, or using reusable shopping bags. Participants were then made to give their impression based on a 10-point scale from heterosexual to homosexual. Kinsey is shaking. He was the first person to use a sexual 10-point scale to actually ask people what their sexual mores were. Participants who learned that a male fictional character exhibited behaviors associated with women said that they were uncertain of his heterosexual identity. The researchers write, in the example of the reusable shopping bag or recycling, men across the board deemed it as feminine, therefore those perceived as being more likely to have positive feminine than positive masculine traits were not associated with manliness. Now, I think a problem with this question is that it is setting it up so that these things matter in the first place. Maybe these participants also need to be asked, like, do you feel that gender matters? Do you feel that sexual roles or gender roles on top of sex matter? Because this whole thing of like they're uncertain, well, it doesn't matter if you're certain or not someone is gay or straight. It doesn't matter. I think that's where we want to be. That just doesn't matter in the context of talking about positive traits. That's what gender abolition means. It just means that it doesn't matter. It doesn't mean that these things don't exist. Of course. Professor Janet K. Swim at Penn State, who led the research, determined that some men might be put off behaving in more eco-friendly manner because of these stereotypes. The research suggested that if being seen as a heterosexual is important to them, which is their frickin' problem, men will opt out of gender nonconforming behaviors with a stigma by that association. A latter part of the study showed that men were most likely to socially distance themselves from gender nonconforming behavior, a social consequence to the construct of gender at large. This is a problem I have with saying, like, women will lead the world, like, the world needs to be run by women, or, like, women need to dominate activist spaces, because then it makes activism, political action, and political, like, it makes it gendered. It makes it something like only the non-gender nonconforming do, which is one of those things that, like, causes quote-unquote cringe, which is emotional distress slash repulsion, because they're afraid of being gay, because gay is bad, and that's the problem, right? Homophobia. I mean, the Earth literally might be uninhabitable by 2040, but no homo. Let's see, last quote. People may avoid certain behaviors because they are managing the gendered impression they anticipate others will have of them. So it's all about, you know, worrying about what other people think of you and all of this authoritarian culture that we have to police each other, be the right way, split ourselves up. Okay, so there's those two stories, which are more in the negative type. Everything else in the show will be more positive. Okay, and we're back from our short musical interlude. So, next up is... Now, I'm always of two minds about the word hope, right? Sometimes hope, and there's many sentiments about hope being itself a delusion, a trick, something that, you know, false hope is maybe is what's referred to, or that hope is something that holds us back in some way, like, you know, we cope with our lives, with the bad things, we dope, you know, to escape into addictions. We hope. And, you know, I think this is just exemplified by a general attitude of, I hope things will get better. I won't do anything about it, but I have hope. But I think then there's the hope that we want to use when we talk about hope that is more proactive and more like, and I'm lacking the language. So I'm going to read something that might give me such language. I'm actually doing, I read half of this. So this is from Earth Island Journal, from an institute think tank. Despairing about the climate crisis, read this. Because we're always kind of, people who are kind of aware of how bad the problem is are always kind of waffling between a hopelessness, nihilism, nothing matters, there's nothing we can do to stop breakdown of the climate and the massive disasters that are coming our way. And not just natural disasters that have to be cleaned up, but changes in the climate changes the growing seasons, which affects how much food we can grow, or how we will grow food, what kind of food we can grow. So this is a conversation with scientist Suzanne Moser about climate communication, the benefits of functional denial, and the varied flavors of hope. So this is written by Lori Mazur, and is published in collaboration with Island Press Urban Resilience Project. Perhaps you are depressed about last year's international climate change report, which said that we have about a decade. It said 12 years, but that was over a year ago now. So about a decade to head off catastrophic climate change. Meaning, and we basically can't meet that by just switching to renewables because it will take at least 30 years to transition to mostly renewables. It's too late. Unless we just stop the economy, right? And that's what Extinction Rebellion is kind of about. Or maybe you're reeling from the UN's recent warning that we may doom 1 million species to extinction. Numbers that we can barely contemplate. These days, the relentless tide of bad news can take a toll on our mental health and on our motivation to stay in the fight. How can we find that sweet spot between denial and despair? Suzanne Moser has given it some thought. In fact, Moser has been thinking about climate change since the mid-80s, when, as a high school student in Germany, she read an article on the subject in one of her mother's magazines. She came to the U.S. to complete a doctorate in climate-related issues, and her long resume includes stints at the Union of Concerned Scientists and the National Center for Aerospatic Research, as well as academic postings at Harvard and Stanford. What an egghead. Moser has always been ahead of the curve. She was writing about climate adaption back in the early 90s before that was a thing, because there was always this kind of assumption we could stop climate change, but really, I guess it was sort of inevitable that it's going to happen. We can't really stop the train, as it were. We can't stop it quickly. A lot of disorder. So it's always been, the narrative has been, we adapt to climate change, right? Capitalists are certainly preparing to. They're bunkering down and investing in police states to control us. That's their way of adapting to climate change. Because when our society breaks down, they can at least survive another generation. Goody for them. Okay. Back on task. Today, in addition to advising governments, nonprofits, and foundations and others on climate change adaptation and the transformational changes required to maintain the kind of conditions that allow for functional society, much less one in which all people in nature can thrive. Moser spends a lot of time thinking about the psychological demands of this fraught moment. In a conversation with Earth Island Journal and Island Press, Moser talks about communicating bad climate news, the benefits of what she calls functional denial, and the varied flavors of hope and the better world we can build in the wreckage of life as we know it. So you've been trying to get people to pay attention to climate change for decades now, they ask. We always hear in the communications field that fear is not motivating, that scaring the bejesus out of people is not productive. But personally, I feel quite motivated by fear, and the science is fearful. Should we pull our punches on that? Because there do seem to be competing narratives about, like, people are only motivated by fear. Fear is a great motivator. But then there's also pollsters that, like, that say that people aren't motivated by fear because we're trying to say how bad it is. And then it's like, it just shocks people into hopelessness right away. Like, oh, it's so bad, there's nothing we can do about it. Which I think is the new Republican line, if they accept the climate change is happening, that we just can't do anything about it. Well, that's not just a conservative right-wing thing. Her answer. Well, there is no doubt that fear is motivational, or else we would not be here as a species, right? If we were not afraid of lions coming out of the grass, we'd be eaten by them. But if you only scare people about telling them what the hell they can do with their fear and how to translate that into protective or remedial action, then you lose them. There are two reactions we have to a threat. We either deal with the threat or we deal with the feeling about the threat. The first option actually reduces the threat. You reduce it, you run away from it, or you build a seawall. The other one is, I don't want to look this awful issue in the face because I don't know what to do, so I'm going to stick my hand in the sand. The same is true of shame, which can move some people. Guilt can, anger can, love can, but if you don't know how to translate these feelings into anything, then even positive feelings won't do you any good. They ask, well, certainly plenty of us are scared. These days, if you're not terrified, you're not paying attention. So how can we recognize the trouble we're in and still get out of bed in the morning? She says, yeah, that's a really good question. Certainly for me, one of the reasons to get out of bed is that we really haven't tried everything. Having done miserably at communication, having done miserably at policy, having done miserably at market responses to climate change gives us a ton of hope because we could do so much better. The other thing is we're short-sighted human beings on many counts, and yet our species has managed to build cathedrals that took 300 years to complete. So it's not like we can't. The future isn't written yet. It is still open in terms of how it's going to be shaped. Still, what we have to realize, and what's dawning on many people now, is that we have to put a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere that won't just come out tomorrow. That's why we have to make space for grief, fear, and all the rest of it in public spaces and in our private lives. We're dealing with a global system that's highly interconnected. We have set so many things in motion that if you tried to control it right now, you couldn't. We have sailed a ship, and the question is, are we going to keep blowing wind into the sails and sending it off into even more troubled waters? Or are we going to do what we can to smooth those waters out and make sure the opening of the harbor is wide enough? Continuing a boat analogy metaphor. She continues. There is a ton of space left in terms of what we can do. We can't just do anything we want because of the things that we have already set in motion. But we can stop making it worse, and there are so many options to deal with the challenges and to make life much less miserable than the vast majority of the world's people. That sums up a lot of American attitudes, it seems, when it comes to their problems. We've tried nothing and are all out of ideas. And so when you don't try a lot of different things, you say, like, the problem is illegal immigration. And, like, well, let's try a wall. Let's try mass deportation. Let's try internment camps. I don't know why they go right to that. That's their inner authoritarian speaking. So they try what they know. Last part of her answer. So I think it's a matter of priorities and values and reckoning with what we have done. In the public sphere, it's called political work. In the private sphere, there is a deeply personal transformational work that needs to be done. So not setting up a false dichotomy slash, you know, false choice between, you know, you got to fix yourself before you fix the world, and just doing political work is banging your head against the wall. If you do just one, yes, they result in either a, you know, individualist impotence or whatever you would call activists running, you know, going around in circles. Certain activism instead of political organizing. Joining something and feeling like you're some part of something bigger, which is why, you know, when it comes to Christian worship, religious worship, it's very personal, it's individualized, and that kind of turns me off, because then, you know, they say, like, well, you do this to feel bigger than something, you're bigger than yourself. I'm like, yeah, but you can do that by joining something, a community, being part of the city, you know, wherever you are, be part of the land and nature. Like, that's something bigger than you. Join it. Right? Doesn't have to be personal and individual. Okay. Next question. You've talked about something you call functional denial. What does that look like? So she says, he explains, the denial part is what we all have. It is incredibly hard to look at the realities we have created in the eye. The functional part is that we have to keep going regardless. On a daily basis, I have to get up in the morning. I have to pay my bills. I have to do my work. I function as if the world was just the regular old world in which everything stays the same and I don't have to worry about too much. If you look at my daily life, it would look like that. If you look more carefully, you might see changes or choices I've made to try to avoid adding to the problem. But by and large, I get out of bed, I drink my tea, I do my life as if nothing else was going on. But at the same time, every day, I face what we have created. If you ask me to stop for a minute and say, how do you feel about that? It can paralyze me, as it does many others. I have so much grief about it. I have so much anger about it. It's all one big morass of emotions that I have about that we humans had the audacity to create out of our blindness and then out of greed and whatever else. So it's that simultaneously. No. Oh boy. I know what that word means, but I'm having trouble actually saying it. It's a combination of spontaneity and similarity. So it's that simularity of being fully aware and conscious and not denying the gravity of what we're creating, and also having to get up in the morning and provide for my family and fulfill my obligations. For me, functional denial is actually a form of hope. I've come to the conclusion we have very little hope literacy in this country, as many other types of literacy are lacking. I think it's something that our education system should shift towards instead of Common Core and whatever standardized testing, is that there just needs to be a demonstration of various types of literacy. New number literacy, media literacy, and I guess another one to add to the list is hope literacy, which I guess is kind of like a psychological, like coping literacy. How well can you cope with problems and react to them? Because as it said, it's not what problems are created, it's how you react to them. So there are many different flavors of hope. One is sometimes called grounded hope, active hope, or authentic hope. That's where you are not at all convinced that there is a positive outcome at the end of your labors. It's not like you're working towards winning something grand. You don't know that you're able to achieve that. But you do know that you cannot live with yourself if you do not do everything towards a positive outcome. So that's how I feel. And it also reminds me of Buddhist values of detachment and the embracement of uncertainty. So we are uncertain about the future. We're uncertain about the outcomes of our work and what we want to do, the outcomes of what we do. And that's something that we need to embrace. It's something to, or very least, tolerate. Instead of just, it's uncertain, so it's not worth doing anything because I don't know what's going to happen. There has to be like this 1-2 result, which is mechanical and thus leads to death. And attitudes and beliefs that are sometimes characterized as a death cult, which American culture is developing several different flavors of death cult. There's the conservative death cult. There's the death cult where, like, you know what the problem is, but you don't want to do anything about it. And you actually think, like, mankind should just end. And then there's the general, like, attitude of people ranting at the end of the week about how trash everyone is. Mostly, and then, like, in talking, a recognition that, like, yeah, I think everyone's trash because I'm not connected to nature or anybody else, really. I'm just doing the grind at work, and I'm coming home tired, and I'm not doing anything that actually brings my life joy. So then there's a radical hope, a term coined by a man named Jonathan Lear, an anthropologist. With radical hope, you don't know at all whether the outcome is positive or negative. Neither the means nor the ends are clear, and you have to reinvent yourself completely to come to peace with whatever that new future is. Between grounded hope and radical hope, that's what we're going to need for climate change. The ask, it sounds like radical hope is useful in times of great uncertainty. Oh, absolutely. Lear came up with the term in the context of studying a Native American tribe that had lost everything. Their land, their livelihoods, their culture, their freedom. They had to completely remake themselves in order to survive. They had a great leader in helping them make that transformation. We don't currently have anyone in this country or in this world that I see who understands what radical cultural transformation requires in terms of leadership. But she doesn't run around in leftist political circles, so I feel like I've met some people like that. But as the journalist says, it seems, in fact, that our leaders are doing precisely the opposite at this moment of uncertainty and promising us a return to some ethereal status quo that we're clearly not going back to, even if that were desirable. This young person says it is not. What's interesting is that I've come to understand uncertainty as a necessary condition for hope. if you're perfectly certain that it's going to be fine or it's going to be hell, you don't need hope because you know exactly what's going to happen. And what people like Trump and other radical right-wingers in particular promise is a certain kind of certainty. In fact, all authoritarianism requires certainty. America is going to be great again. It's going to be purely white, and we're going to have great economy, and we're the best, quoting Trump. That's all a form of certainty. Whereas, quote, the future is going to look very different, and I can't tell you how, but we're going to have to go through that together and figure out and create it. That's uncertainty. That requires work. It's also very unpopular. And that's also the thing about democracy, is that you don't actually know what the outcome will be. And that uncertainty freaks people out too. And that's why they just prefer one person decide things or a small group of people. Representative government is actually a form of a small group deciding for a very large group. So they can feel certain that someone is taking care of it. So the interviewer, you know, puts out, we're so bad at handling uncertainty. And that's probably the most unsettling thing. Well, it is unsettling, and it's difficult work. We're bad at it. And that is the grounds for transformation. We have absolutely zero illusion about how hard this is going to be, and that we have absolutely no guarantee we're going to make it to the other side. So I'll tell you that up front. But because we're finally loosening from those set ways, there's actually opportunity. You cannot transform if you stay the same. It sounds trite, but if you hold on to that way it has been, you're going to stay the same. So you have to let go of the cliff. And you're going to look like a fool. You're going to make a lot of mistakes. My God, you're going to go scratching down that cliff. It's not going to look pretty, but it's the only way you have a chance of actually changing. Referring to like the cliff that, say, we're running off of, like coyote style. We do seem to be going off a cliff as a society, so it's helpful to see that there is a necessary transformation. Moser says, yeah, and this is the kind of framing that we need, the kind of leadership that we need, to help us understand that this is a process. It's a very archetypical process. Maybe we've never been at this much risk as a species, but it's not like we have never had to go through anything similar. I'll point out that anthropologically speaking, the human race there was a bottleneck in our evolution where there was just 10,000 humans. That was probably a close call. Maybe migration is a good example. You have to let go of your homeland, and you set off on a ship in an ocean. You don't know whether the boat is going to hold up or whether the captain knows anything about where he's going. It's a metaphorically perfect illustration of what we're doing. We let go of something old in order to go through great uncertainty and come to a new place where we unfold in new ways. Last part. There are people out there who are skipping the hope part, who believe that it's inevitable that climate change or something else will cause the collapse of civilization, and they're getting ready for that. I'm thinking of the Dark Mountain Project and various prepper communities on the both left and right. What do you think of that approach? She answers, what's interesting to me is that they skipped right from one certainty, we're going to be fine, it's not going to be bad, to another certainty, we're all screwed. For example, Jem Bendo in the UK has put forward a deep adaptation agenda on his Facebook page, on his LinkedIn group. He basically forbids a conversation about anything in between. We're going to be fine on the one hand, and we're screwed, we're going to die in the next 5 decades on the other. For Bendo, and also the Dark Mountain Project, they are finding community with each other and building social capital that is absolutely crucial to get through the tough spot that we're going through. But the preppers, the people who just buy their generator and their guns and store food for 3 months, I'm worried about them. In America, where there's so many guns, we're going to shoot each other, and it's very scary to me. It's a very individualistic, survivalist approach, whereas the Dark Mountain Project and Jem Bendel's deep adaptation are actually doing some of the deep psychological and social work required to get to a different place. And I want to contrast this, Dan Platt speaking, with the mechanical STEM/engineering approach to all of our problems, which is the technocratic approach. That if you're trained to think mechanistically about everything and that there's a technical solution to every problem, you ignore the psychological, you ignore the social. And that stuff breaks down, and then you keep trying to create technical fixes to fix the social problems created by the technology. So community is a key ingredient of the transformational change that needs to happen if we're going to come out on the other side of this. There's no doubt that the harsh conditions we're currently creating will make us dependent on each other in ways we don't even know yet. We're so focused on, can I protect myself from this? Can I survive on whatever? Even, where can I move? As if there is a place to hide from global change. But you have any chance of surviving as a species, we need to share resources to bring the weakest and most marginalized into the center of our communities. And yeah, we're going to get a lesson in dependence and interdependence like you haven't seen. Well, none of us have seen. I say, stay put if you can and get to know your neighbors. I've heard that before. Internalized it. I could not agree more of that prescription, but I also can't help but notice that that doesn't seem to be the direction we're heading in as a society. I'm trying to do my best to change that. It's not just the climate news, but also the societal condition. The political inability to make anything happen across partisan lines. That feed into people's despair, fostering social capital wherever we are. In the workplace, at the neighborhood level, in communities, it's absolutely crucial. Hope doesn't hinge on a rosy picture of the future. I really believe that the amount of suffering and the amount of cruelty that we're capable of is very large. But I also believe that people do have a heart and are desperate for something other than what this currently is. There are millions of people who don't know how to engage with this in a constructive way and feel powerless, which is feeding their despair. But who are not on board with the viciousness and hatred and divisiveness that you get on TV every minute of the day? They say, it's very true. The way we live now in this culture, which has caused climate change, is such a radical break from most of human history. Returning to a more cooperative way of living could be like coming home. Moser says, yes, it is relearning something that we once knew, at least on a species level. We keep talking about the three Fs, fight, flight, or freeze. But there was a fourth one, and that's the one that's actually helped us survive. And what's that? She makes a fourth F, which is the forming of bonds or the befriending. That's the piece that got us to cooperate as a species and recognize that we have greater advantage when we work together as opposed to everyone for themselves. This is biology, if you want to be deterministic about it. It is in the genetic history of our species. We are here because we cooperated. It's a part of us. So that's part of, like, if you want to be deterministic about what human nature, and it's human nature to fight or whatever. Well, it's also human nature, or rather it has been human nature to cooperate, to share. And if socialism and communism are scary labels for you, I've heard some libertarians use the word communalism to basically refer to what I'm actually for. Since what I'm for is not, you know, what was done in the 20th century, but an evolution of that, taking some of the ideas and then adapting them to our times. And then she ends with definitely a social ecology kind of quip. When you imagine it, what is the best thing about the new world? That we are not, that we will not be the non-dominant species. I'm not the first one to say that, but it's basically the idea of keeping the Anthropocene to a really thin layer in the geologic record and being one among many species that live on this planet within the confines of its resources without damaging it. And in fact, making it a part of our species' purpose to recreate and nourish the conditions for the continuity of life. In my highest aspirations for the species, that's what we will be, servants of life. Interesting take with that old language there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so let's summarize this a little bit. And maybe I'll just return that a positive hope, right, that isn't toxic, is one that embraces uncertainty. And it's also how we get out of the mind and fear traps that so many are in, that cause us to panic or freeze and be completely paralyzed with fear or paralyzed into inaction. With the recent mass shootings, we always basically have one every month, but having two on the same day, you know, really freaked people out, I guess. In Times Square, you have a lot of people who probably aren't used to crowds, aren't used to crowd spaces, but they're in a very popular / place of importance, you know, Times Square as a symbol of commercialism and whatnot. A lot of the mass shootings happen in everyday places. You know, they're outside of Walmart, they're in a school, whatever. They're not really at government spaces or places that are actually secured. And I guess secured by the police state. So that's why the police had to calm everyone down that there actually wasn't a shooting at Times Square, but there was a motorcycle that backfired. It went pop, pop, pop. And apparently people, you know, either don't know what gunfire sounds like or what regular New York City traffic noise sounds like. Because, you know, if they're a tourist, they don't. There was a mass stampede and a lot of people were hurt, like 20, 25 people. Some of them heavily hospitalized because of the fear that drives them. And they were interviewing people after. It was quite unsettling. Just like that people's first instinct was, I'm going to die. This is it. Because a motorcycle backfired. Right? Because they were just in that mindset that something terrible is going to happen or everything's going to be fine and that there's no in between. I'm afraid this sounds like a call for moderation or some kind of in the middle-ism, which is like, but no, I'm far left wing. And although this piece, Mosner, talks in terms of like, you know, they mention the hyper-partisanship. And so I have to come to grips with my partisan nature in this, the partisan positions of this and kind of trajectory of this program. Very partisan program. I admit it. We live in a society with everyone in it. And even though, like, if I just think about what I want and what I want to share with people and find the like-minded, I'm building a society that is separate. That is not America. But that's where decentralization comes in. It's where, you know, look, I don't believe in this United States of America thing. Obviously, there's a collaboration of 50 states plus, and that's better than not having it. But that's where we turn federations into confederations, where we have agreements between states and areas and localities and regions, and then we can have a bioregionalism. Now I'm just using a bunch of terms, so I'll just stop. So otherwise, this has been the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt. I'm going to be still continuing to live stream on Facebook at Three Left Show page and continue into the next hour. So thank you very much.
I'd just like to take a moment to tell the kids in the audience that as an adult, I'd like to apologize for my generation because you are fucked. We tried, but it just hasn't worked out. And so, since you're not going to get truly what is rightfully yours, and you should have, I say, you start stealing shit from your parents. You have every right. You have every right. Go for it. And you also deserve a lot of credit for this past election because you were the engine behind the election of Obama. The adults can't take credit for that. If it was up to my generation, we would have slept fuck through it. But his appeal to you is understandable because he is the first president, certainly in my lifetime, who's filled with hope. His nipples are actually bursting with hope. And when you're young, son of a bitch, there's nothing better than hope. Really, it's the best drug there is. There's no better drug than hope. That's for sure, and I tried them all. But I'm 60. And fuck hope. I mean, to be honest, I'm not even sure I believe in Bob Hope. Hope was the greatest thing on earth when I was young. Hopes would have allowed me to craft a little basket. And I filled it with my dreams and my visions of all the things I wanted to be and I wanted my country to be and I wanted the world to be. And my father and mother said, take that down the street. And those folks down there, they'll help you. They'll help you see all of this come true. And I took it down there and they took the basket and they said, wow, that's the most lovely little basket of hope we've ever seen. And then they put it on the ground and shit all over it. But that didn't bother me because I had hope. And hope's what allowed me to wash that basket off. And I filled that basket up again and again and again. And as I grew older, I became more specific. You know, I felt that in a country as rich as ours, no one should ever go to bed hungry. And that there certainly should be an educational system that allows every child to pursue whatever dream they have. And no one should have to choose between finances and their health. And for fuck's sake, there ought to be flying cars. But none of the things that I've wanted, none of the things that I've hoped for have come to pass. And that doesn't bother me anymore because I know exactly when it will happen. And it will. Everything that I've ever dreamed of is going to happen. And it will happen the day after I die.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, know-it-all activist, secretary of the local Green Party, and generally neutral energy person. Now, to kind of bring it back down to a functionalist level, I've got two stories about localities, you know, progressive blue city, by blue, you know, Democrat cities, that are doing things to put limits on our consumption and the accesses and the inefficiencies, the waste that is destroying the planet and ourselves. But here's a story that might get a very serious mixed reaction, even from people who know that, you know, we want to transition to renewable energy, right? Everyone wants to transition to renewable energy. But then when you actually bring up the actual doing of that, you know, and transitioning off of fossil fuels, that means natural gas too. You know, we don't want like fracking. We have banned fracking in New York. And if we want it to end in the rest of the country, where it's poisoning people's water and all the rest of the pollution, the massive amounts of methane that makes it actually worse for the atmosphere than burning coal, or at least just as bad, we need to phase out natural gas too. But then there'll be a knee jerk, but I don't like cooking with electric. But Berkeley becomes the first U.S. city to ban natural gas in new homes. So this is usually, you know, when it comes to transition, it means that anything new you do, it's just relating to new things. So, you know, changing the infrastructure in all pre-existing housing is economically infeasible. But here it is. Natural gas piping for stoves or water heaters will be forbidden in new buildings in Berkeley, California, beginning in 2020. So next year, which isn't so far off. But that's the problem, isn't it? That 2020, this far-off year where we can start the transition, you know, it's here. It's now. And at least in Berkeley, they're taking that seriously to say, like, yes, in 2030, good portion of the city will actually not be heated with fossil fuels. So here's the story by Sarah Ravina, and I'm reading from the San Francisco Chronicle. Berkeley has become the first city in the nation to ban the installation of natural gas lines in new homes. The city council on Tuesday night unanimously voted to ban gas from new low-rise residential buildings starting January 1st. I don't know what that means about high-rise buildings, but Berkeley isn't exactly a tall place. It's not the first time Berkeley has passed pioneering health or environmental legislation. In 1977, Berkeley was the first in the country to ban smoking in restaurants and bars. In January, the city banned single-use disposables, requiring restaurants to use to-go foodware that is compostable. That's even better than just, say, banning styrofoam, which we've done in my county. So now, like, we don't have styrofoam containers. They're all still plastic containers that can't be composed. Bowl or anything like that, but at least they're not leaching poison into everything. The natural gas ordinance introduced by Councilwoman Kate Harrison requires a new single-family home, townhomes, and small apartment buildings, okay, to have electric infrastructure. After its passage, Harrison thanked the community and her colleagues. It's an enormous issue, she tells the Chronicle. We need to really tackle this. When we think about pollution and climate change issues, we tend to think about factories and cars. But all buildings are producing greenhouse gases. The city will include commercial buildings and larger residential structures as the state moves to develop regulations for those, officials say. The ordinance allocates about, I'm going to say, $250,000 a year to a two-year staff position in the Building and Safety Division of their planning department. The employee will be responsible for implementing the ban. So actual oversight. The ordinance applies to buildings that have been reviewed by the California Energy Commission and determined to meet state requirements. if they are electric only, says the Berkeley's Community Advisory Commission. The way the ordinance is written, the city's regulations will update as the State Commission approves more building models without having to return to the City Council for a vote. We need to find ways to move forward innovative, groundbreaking climate policy. Noting he spoke as a private citizen and not as a representative of the commission. This policy is really... Okay, he takes his commissioner hat off. This policy is really important and critical. Helps address one of the largest sources of emissions in Berkeley. Very much so. In 2009, the city adopted its climate action plan aimed to reduce emissions by a third by 2020, 80% by 2050. The plan also commits the city to using all renewables, electricity by 2035. But you see, if you still heat everything with gas, you're still using an enormous amount of fossil fuels. So how are you meeting these goals? But they're actually taking correct steps, in my opinion. The city determined in a report last year that gas-related emissions have increased due to 18% population growth since 2000. See, emissions are going up because we actually haven't changed the basic infrastructure. The report also noted that burning of natural gas within city buildings accounted for 27% of Berkeley's total emissions in 2016. So to put that in context, 27% is equivalent to 20 million gallons of gasoline, says Harrison. As the city's population soars, the need for more housing has also increased. So from 14 to 17, instead of having natural gas pipes, electric-only buildings install heat pumps, referring to geothermal, which is pipes that go underground, and then because underground, it's always 55 degrees, so you can heat water up or cool it down a little bit, and then you heat that water up with electric, as well as induction cooking. Think about a refrigerator and how it makes inside your refrigerator cold and blows hot air out of somewhere else, Gould said. A heat pump works like that, but in reverse. It takes outside air and emits cold air outside and provides hot air inside. They can also be flipped in reverse and work as an air conditioner. Okay, yeah, so, sorry, so it wasn't geothermal, but a geothermal system can also be called a heat pump because instead of doing it with outside air, it's doing it with heat slash cold that is underground. Induction cooking transfers heat directly to any magnetic cookware, including cast iron steel, without using radiation. Restaurateur Jonathan Lavinia said that chefs prefer to work with open flames because that is how they have been trained. But Lavinia, whose full scoop is planning to open a Berkeley location, said that with climate change worsening, it is their responsibility to adapt. He said he supports Berkeley's ordinance. I think we all have to do our part in some way or another. As citizens of this world, when do we start taking responsibility? As chefs in the industry, we try to reduce our carbon footprint and try to source as local as possible, referring to the ingredients. I think this is just going to be the new normal. That is the kind of attitude I like to see. At Tuesday's meeting, Harrison's staff demonstrated the use of an induction cooktop by making chocolate fondue. The staff placed a piece of paper between the stove and the pot to show its safety features. The pot turned hot, but the paper didn't burn. Nearly 40 people spoke at the city council meeting Tuesday in support of it. Tom Lent, a Berkeley resident, said he changed his gas stove to an electric cooktop about 3 years ago. Cooking with induction is really fun, says Lent during a public comment. It's so fast and it's very controllable. I will never go back to gas. Christian Davis, the co-owner of KC's Barbecue in Berkeley, said she prefers using a gas stove over electric cooktop. I just prefer an open flame, Davis said. I don't think there is a huge difference in the taste, but I do think the taste is a little more enhanced over an open flame. Okay, well there's feeling, that's feelings over facts, isn't it? I don't think there's a huge difference, but there's a difference and it matters. And I'm ready to accept burning down the world if it means my food can taste a little bit better. But I just don't know how much. Davis said she's concerned that installing electric equipment in new restaurants could be a financial burden for small businesses. Fine. Harrison acknowledged that electric appliances might be more expensive, but she said the use of electric equipment is cost effective in the long term. Electricity on an ongoing basis will be less expensive, she says. So that's the end of that. I also want to point out in terms of heating that there's a difference. There needs to be also a difference in attitudes when it comes to heating buildings. Gas and other, you know, in heating of the past, using even oil burning furnaces, is about heating the entire space. But you need to think about your own body? Are you using all the space? Why does all of the space need to be heated? Why not just heat some of the space? And that's where electric heaters are fine. You only need to heat, you know, square, you know, 10 square feet, and that's the 10 square feet that you are using at any one time. Because electric heaters can get hot really fast, and thus heat the air around them really fast. Gas burning things take a very long time to heat things up. Because it's using induction, it's using convection, you know, it's heating hot water up, and that hot water then has to make the water hot, and it's just a lot of steps, and you lose a lot of energy and efficiency with each step that a system takes. So we need to think about heating ourselves, and that's where kind of designing furniture that kind of things that kind of keep heat in, if we're talking about heating. Another similar story, but now about cars, which I covered in from Streets Blog USA. They have their own podcast, and they cover smart growth, which I don't like as a concept, but transit and but bikes and pedestrians and whatever. So it's they're on my you know, I agree with them. Minneapolis, a different progressive city, has just banned drive-thrus. Written by Angie Smith. The Minneapolis City Council just banned drive-thrus, a move proponents say will make roadways safer and make the air cleaner. Drive-thru windows, such as those at fast food joints or, ironically, liquor stores, are not that widespread in the Paris of the High Plains, according to a local news site, Wedge Live. And even though existing drive-thrus will be grandfathered in, the zoning reform could still have important implications. Research has shown that areas around fast food restaurants are especially dangerous for pedestrians because drive-thrus require more driveways, which introduce potential points of conflict. Plus, drivers tend to be distracted just before they have ordered their food and in the moments when they start driving away with it. A Florida study found that each fast food restaurant in a low-income block added an average of about 0.7 pedestrian crashes every 4 years. McDonald's, Wendy's, Taco Bell were all associated with a greater risk of severe injuries. Minneapolis Council said that this measure, would improve air quality by reducing idling, incrementally helping the city comply with its goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by 2050. Now, why are these goals always 80% and not 100%? Because it's assumed that there has to be some kind of fossil fuel burning or that there's going to be grandfathered things in. I'm not even certain. Maybe 30 years will be enough, but 30 years is not fast enough to actually prevent catastrophic climate change. But we still want to make the world better and prepare to adapt and know our neighbors, as I covered previously. The measure is part of a series of progressive improvements contained in the Minneapolis 2040 plan. So again, two stories of progressive cities that have, you know, climate change plans, which are pretty much set up to take too long. Because there's a difference between, like, the reducing of emissions is actually more about trying to prevent climate change than adapting to it. Because, you know, you can switch to renewables and switch to electric, but then you still have to generate the electricity. And that, as it's currently the transition to renewables is happening, still depends on the global trade networks and global industry and global capitalism. And if that gets disrupted, like with a depression or just the next recession when it happens, what then? All of these things will be put on hold. You know, there will be calls to, we can't afford to do this, or we can't threaten the economy of the 20th century that, of course, still busts every cycle. So in a previous episode, I covered about how flying and jet travel and airplane travel is an enormous contributor to our carbon footprint, to global pollution, because it truly is global. Because it is, in fact, global travel that creates it. I think it's very positive that the young climate activist from Sweden who's coming to speak to the UN, she's traveling by sailboat. And the thing about modern technology and living in the 21st century is we have sailboats that can actually move very, very fast. I don't actually know quite specs of like how long would it take across the Atlantic, but it's no longer a month journey. Maybe it's like a week. Similarly, like taking the train takes... If you do cross country, it takes like a few days, three, pretty much. But 3 days to cross the country is still really, really good compared to centuries past. But yes, it's not the half a day that it takes to take a plane. But the cost of that convenience. This is from Green World, which is a Green Party site. I think it's just the Global Green Party, because the Green Party is a network of parties across the world, because there are Green Parties in about 100 countries. This is called Seven Strategies for the Degrowth of Aviation. Magdalena Hussweier, a co-founder of the Anti-Aviation Campaign Network, Stay Grounded, discusses seven strategies to reduce flying and build a just transport system. So this is probably something you probably didn't even know existed. You know, jet travel is a big carbon sink, is a big polluter, and yet does the environmental movement address it? Is it, you know, I usually don't see it, but here you are. Since green flying is very likely to remain an illusion in the decades ahead, and by the way, the best thing that many of these companies do, in as far as like being green and greenwashing themselves, is to then offer carbon offset credits, because they can't actually make themselves green. They can't actually make themselves not polluting. They offer offset credits, and this actually drives me a little mad. It makes me mad. I saw a kind of environmentalist friend of mine, like she traveled somewhere and rented a car. And these rent-a-car companies are doing the same thing of offering like carbon offset credits. So it's like, I'm going green with a rent-a-car. Like, well, why doesn't the rent-a-car just have all electric cars then? Okay. So green flying is an illusion. The only way to counter the harmful climate impacts of aviation is reduced flying. In current discussions, the focus often remains on the individual level, shaming people who fly, but this is too narrow an approach. Now, I said so when I covered the problem of flying, where the guy took an individual shame-based approach, and I was like, okay, whatever. At the moment, everything encourages people to fly, be it cheap prices, advertisements, or simply lack of alternatives. It is no wonder that the number of flights is growing dramatically. For every one person that decides to stop flying, we may see 50 more start. If this is something we want to avoid, we need structural change. You know, system change, not climate change. Motto of the Green Party. On the 12th to the 14th of July in Barcelona, the Degrowth of Aviation Conference discussed seven different measures to reduce aviation. The conference was organized by the Stay Grounded Network and brought together 150 people from all over the world who did not take a single flight to get there. Present were scientists, climate activists, feminist initiatives, NGOs, trade unions, social movements, and neighborhood initiatives from Barcelona who fight mass tourism and the expansion of the airport, as well as initiatives fostering alternatives like night trains and sailing ships. On the last day of the conference, we took direct action, forming a red line at the airport in Barcelona to show our opposition to further growth. While there are many ways to reduce aviation and build a just transport system, seven of them were discussed in detail. Okay, here they are. Number one, end tax exemptions. While taxes do not solve our problems, it is no option to continue with indirect and unjust subsidies for the aviation industry. Kerosene and flight tickets need to be taxed at rates similar to or higher than other modes of transport. Since on an EU or worldwide level, this is currently hard to implement, countries should take these steps and make bilateral agreements with others to also put taxes on international flights. The revenues should be used to foment alternatives to flying. Target frequent flyers. In addition to ending tax privileges for the aviation industry, the injustice involved in aviation can be targeted by implementing a frequent flyer levy. On a worldwide scale, more than 80% of people have never flown, while for a few, flying even several times a year has become a normality. These are usually wealthy people, and their mode of living is sustained to the detriment of those already facing down the climate crisis. Therefore, it is proposed that a levy, for example, 100 euros or 90 pounds or $90, be implemented when someone takes their second flight in a year. The cost then doubles with each flight taken that year. This way, people who only very rarely fly to visit their family in another continent are not disadvantaged, while everyone is disincentivized to fly more frequently. The revenues would go to making environmentally friendly transport modes like trains more affordable and the support sectors dependent on tourism and flights to transition towards climate jobs. because this whole thing about local economies, wherever they may be, being dependent on tourism, kind of, I'm uncomfortable with it. And short haul and domestic flights. The above price mechanisms have to go along with limiting those flights that can easily be transferred to trains or buses. This measure can be implemented very quickly in the coming years, and a ban must go hand in hand with offering more and better alternatives. And yes, I do recognize this is a wish list and is all very politically unpopular and unfeasible, but here goals are important. And just talking about that, to have the imagination of doing things differently. Number four, foster alternatives to flights. In Europe, the train infrastructure has been improved, offering comfortable night trains, good connections, accessible booking systems. High-speed trains are not necessarily the best alternative, since energy use rises exponentially with the speed of the trains. We have to consider whether a transport system compatible with limits of our planet and the crisis we face might also mean slower travel and trade. Of course, we should also be researching into the possibilities of a modern shipping industry based around renewable energy, as well as providing good online conference systems in order to avoid work travel, which many activists already do, and companies as well. But larger multinationals will still, their executives will travel everywhere in person because apparently it's so goddamn important. Number five, putting limits on airports themselves. Expanding airports and constructing new ones both accommodates rising demand of flights, kind of like building new lanes on a highway just means you get more traffic, and creates a business impetus to boost demand to fill the growing capacity. That's supply-side economics, by the way. There are about 1,200 airport infrastructure projects around the world, many of them connected to violations of human rights and destruction of biodiversity or agricultural land. Airports also put people under constant noise and pollution pressure. Putting a memoranda on new airport infrastructure establishes limits for flight numbers, the noise, and scales down existing airports wherever possible, and which is very important to stopping the growth of the sector. Number six is to change tourism itself. The consequences of over-tourism are hitting more and more cities and countries and are closely connected to low-cost airlines and the growth of the aviation sector. A standard joke that a place becomes so popular, no one goes there anymore. But that's usually referring to local people not going there anymore. Some cities already put limits on the number of cruisers that are allowed to enter the port or limit entrance to overcrowded areas. In Barcelona, social movements are fighting against platforms like Airbnb that contribute to high rising rents and gentrification. Putting different kinds of limits, this might include reducing work hours and establishing the right to take sabbaticals so that the need for a quick one-night, one-week holiday is reduced. Change travel policies in institutions. While most of the above measures would need to be re-established at a government policy level, universities, NGOs, trade unions, and the like, other institutions could also take the lead and serve as role models by implementing travel policies that support more sustainable mode of transports. The conference ended with a call to action. In order to bring about this needed change, a hands-on approach is necessary, and everyone can take part, says Stay Grounded's Mira Catfinger. We need social movements demanding this in the streets. We need direct actions at airports. We need science. We need institutions and companies showing the advantages of staying grounded and slow travel. And we need civil society pressuring government to follow up. So maybe you've heard of like the slow food movement, a slow this movement, slow that movement. There is definitely a need to slow down. And then it's interesting that it isn't, one would think it's like almost a conservative position to slow down. But we're not talking about slowing down cultural change. In fact, slowing down at this moment would be increasing cultural change. It would be accelerating it. So we don't want to accelerate the disaster or the harms of our system. We want to accelerate change. And that makes it progressive instead of conservative, even though the position is to put limits on things and so on. Because, you know, what's being conserved is the status quo of modernity, which mechanizes everything, it commodifies everything. But you have to go slow and put limits on things. It's actually the progressive thing to do. Because it is different than what we have now and in the recent past, the last century, where everything has to be faster, more, overconsumption, which everyone kind of knows is kind of wrong, but doesn't, you know, what's the alternative? And then we're told there is no alternative. Well, there is an alternative. There is an alternative to flying. There is an alternative to the growth of flying. There's an alternative to everything that is actually harming us.
Everyone makes mistakes. I've had more than my share. But it's okay, cause I'm gonna repair it. They say there are no retakes, but I just don't agree.
Okay, and I'm back from my musical interlude, because I figured out what I'm going to do the rest of the show. Because I want to focus on the kind of smaller scale solutions, but still address the structural problems of what we're doing now. So, from a kind of single-person blog, Sivaquada Farms, man's name is Chris Newman, via the Medium platform. He has titled his piece, Small Family Farms Aren't the Answer. Subtitled, The Romance of Neoliberal Peasant Farming Blinds Us to Our Collective Power. So he starts, let's get this out of the way first. I am a small farmer, operating a 40-ish acres in Virginia's Northern Neck. I am not paid by, in hock to, in league with, or particularly happy with big agriculture. I'm just a guy who's been in the small sustainable farming business long enough to understand that the model is fatally flawed and mature enough to say it out loud. To my friends that run and staff farmers markets, This essay is hard on farmers markets. It's not because I don't love you, but because I'm describing how restorative agriculture needs to evolve in order to compete without sacrificing its values. So now, the critique. I recently found myself with the free time to do some simple math. One of the larger farmers markets I participate in has about 100 vendors. I'm one of the mid-sized operations that sells there, and I'm paying about $1,000 a year in fees to participate in the market. I'm also devoting about 250 hours a year in staffing and prep time, so let's call that another $3,000, and about $650 in getting the fuel of getting to and from there, plus another $1,200 in wear and tear on my vehicles. Altogether, then, I'm paying roughly $5,800 to participate in a large farmer's market. It's pretty safe to assume that the costs of the other 99 vendors are similar. We're shelling out a combined $500,000 to participate in just one market. Most of us participate in at least two markets, so let's double that figure to a little over $1,000,000. Then round down to $1,000,000 to be conservative about it. Now, as a $1,000,000 plus annual operating budget could comfortably lease, service, and staff a large urban brick and mortar market that would be open half the day, 7 days a week, year round. Instead, we spend it on a pop-up market that's open just half the year, in my neck of the woods, for 2 days a week, remember, that's two markets, 4 hours at a time. And it's probably outdoors, where rain, excessive heat, or cold snap will effectively ruin your day. As much as I like farmers markets, the amount of resources that small farmers pour into them is terribly misdirected, and if we're serious about mounting a real challenge to the conventional food system. So farmers markets as they are now, he says, are more about the consumers feeling good about shopping there than actually doing good and having an actual brick and mortar store that local farmers can either sell to or simply have stalls in. Certain food co-ops kind of already do this to some extent, and many supermarkets will like make a promotion out of buying from a local farm and basically having like almost something like a farm stand set up where a section of their produce area, you know, department will be this local farm. Next part. The cultural power of farmers markets is a symptom of what's fundamentally wrong with sustainable and regenerative agriculture. The veneration of the small family farm. It's the sacred cow of American cultural identity, dating back at least to Thomas Jefferson's dream of the nation of yeoman farmers. But it also goes back farther than that because he got that idea from somewhere. America's oldest farmers, indigenous people, generally regard the soil as a commons and worked it cooperatively. Many indigenous, you know, First Nations, along with a number of religious and ethnic communities, continue to practice to this day. But the notion of a private farm, be it a pair of greenhouses or tens of thousands of acres, is what came to dominate American farming, and it's taken particular hold among the farm-to-table cohort. We, in that cohort, trade the benefits of agrarian collectivism, living wages, retirement, a sane workload, profitability, as well as survivability, and the capacity to make a game-changing impact in the marketplace, for rugged independence, complete autonomy in decision-making, the ability to grow what, where, how we want, to set our prices as we please, to sell wherever we please, and so on. And the work, but also the freedom to work ourselves into the ground. And this is also a critique I kind of have of the sole business owner that is proud that it's a 24/7 job. In short, we've done the most modern American thing possible. We have bartered away our quality of life for the freedom to be miserable. Our freedom also costs us results in the marketplace. The zeal for saving the world is undercut by annual sales at farmers markets estimated at least $2 billion in the U.S., with the growth of markets slowing even as hundreds of billions of dollars of food is sold annually in grocery stores. As the link above states, part of the slowdown may be the result of an explosion in local food hubs, which are themselves riddled with competitive issues of their own, in addition to, generally, being non-farmer owned and little more than middlemen that force farmers to take prices. We may actually have one coming to my neighborhood. So, because the guy who's building it, he's building it because it's like a popular thing to do, to bake a food hub. So I'm both kind of excited to have a food hub, but also very, very suspicious and maybe even cynical about it. Because the guy just owns property and he just wants to develop. And what can he develop in a rundown black urban neighborhood? Food hub. Okay, because of our insistence on independence and our failure to cooperate more closely, we're being outsold at the grocery store by a factor of 400+. Accounting for on-farm, food hub, restaurant, and other non-market sales does little to affect the scale of this imbalance. Farmers markets and other local outlets punch well above their weight in terms of social and cultural value, but this is fooling us into believing we're making more of an impact than we actually are. Feeling good, not doing good. And that a rapidly consolidating food system backed by venture capital, entrenched interests, and the world's wealthiest, the 1%, will somehow be displaced by the romance of a neoliberal peasant farmer. Go to a big farmer's market this weekend and have a look around. Each of those independent producers would tell you interesting stories. 80-plus hour work weeks. Getting by without health insurance. Paying employees next to nothing or relying on volunteers. Supplementing with outside jobs. Enduring broken marriages. Worn out bodies. Social isolation. Strained finances and, of course, emotional burnout. These are the conditions my grandfather's generation endured that convinced their children to get as far away from the farm as possible. The current and relatively young generation of back-to-the-landers diving into an ocean of nostalgia for pearls that aren't there is setting the stage for similar generational exit when their children come of age. Unless, of course, we choose a different way. Imagine all the producers at that market combining their acreage, their expertise, their supply chain, and financial resources into a co-op committed to producing food regeneratively, responsibly, and ethically. The results would be astonishing. But here are the results that Heave predicts. The cost of production would decrease significantly. Orders of seed, feed, equipment, supplies would no longer be in bulk. They'd be at a regional scale. Labor hours would be reduced as dozens of farmers are no longer replicating the same tasks, such as their purchasing, their bookkeeping, their inventory, etc. This is the advantages of actually mass planning economically instead of market economics. The chaos of it, the inefficiency, that you have, you know, all these workers, all these owners, these business owners basically doing the same work when they could be sharing that work. Their market share would, of course, swell. Owning to lower prices, larger quantities, and more accessible markets, we'd be able to deliver service. And by more accessibility, he means brick and mortar as well as delivering. We'd be able to service a much larger segment of the market. It's not efficient for one farmer to do home delivery, but if 100 farmers pitch in, they could have a service. They could afford that. So it's all a matter of scale. Wages and quality of life for farmers would then rise in real terms. The confluence of reduced production costs, cooperative labor, increased market share, will mean individual farmers are working less and getting paid more. We'd actually be able to enjoy the creature comforts of other industries, like having their weekends and evening weekends off, group health insurance, and even retirement. Retirement! The barriers to entry for new farmers would be much lower. New farmers would not have to learn to be entrepreneurs, marketers, and agritourism experts. And this is my misgivings and complaints about starting a small business and things. Like, you're starting from scratch. And now, of course, there are these, like, you know, small business things. Sustainable farming could be then gentrified, since it would no longer be a labor of love, only available to people that can afford to work for free or next to nothing. Everyone, people of color in particular, would be able to look at farming as a viable career choice. See, it's like, and this is where, like, to say that something is racist, that's discriminatory, is to just point out that there are current economic barriers that blacks and people of color can't meet. Farmers could follow their passions instead of diversifying. The co-op has producers of livestock, produce, fruit, mushrooms, and so on. Farmers can actually focus on growing one thing, because if they're on their own, they have to grow a little bit of everything. He adds a extra factoid. We net more money selling 100 chickens to a single restaurant at a 30% discount than we do to 100 individuals, because that bulk order means that we are not paying for individual storage, transport, potential spillage, fees, cost of point of sale, so on. Farmers in a co-op can also operate at the scale they choose. If someone just wants to grow microgreens in their basement and sell them into the co-op's single-payer market, so be it. If they want to range a cattle herd fathered by sheep and chickens across a few hundred acres leased and owned by the co-op, go for it. The only constraint is that the producer must follow the co-op's standards. Point is, these farmers would no longer be alone. They would no longer be alone. You join something, you're not alone anymore. We present a united farmer-owned, and this is key, interface to the rest of the world. Suppliers, customers, landlords, regulators, media, that, at present, each farmer is left alone to handle. It's that isolation that makes us weak and ineffective against incredibly well-resourced competition. We have to evolve if we're going to survive. Now, of course, subscribing to this model is going to take a big mental leap for some farmers, because participating in a co-op does mean surrendering some autonomy. You have to adhere to a group's agreed-upon regenerative growing practice. But we kind of do this anyway. You don't get to set your own prices, but you don't necessarily have to sell anymore either. You just get paid a salary. And there may be limits around what gets produced. You know, crops that maybe use more water than they should. A big change is that the farmer isn't just accountable to themselves. They're accountable to all the other co-owners. But that accountability goes both ways. And the farmer has both a voice and a vote in an organization that's big enough to compete, but small enough for each voice to vote and matter. Without that change, each farmer is left alone and isolated, having to handle their own leases, purchasing, packaging, bookkeeping, staffing, to say nothing of doing the full-time job of farming itself. It's categorically unsustainable, and extractive agricultural interests are counting on it. In particular, they're counting on farmers being so preoccupied with non-farming tasks that we don't have the headspace to consider alternatives or to act strategically. We don't work all the time and are physically, mentally exhausted. We simply don't have the time to think. Notice he's talking about farmers, but he could be talking about any of us. It applies across the board, and that's why this is a great piece. And they're counting on farmers internalizing the mythic virtue of a rugged independence, which keeps us isolated and denies us the efficiency, the effectiveness, and the power of acting collectively to counterman the efficiency and the effectiveness of power of private capital. But now that we know this, it's time to do things differently. So now he describes his farm. Our farm has access to thousands of acres of land near Washington, D.C., only a fraction of which we're able to actively farm since there's only three or four of us. We've resolved to evolve our business into a farming collective for all the reasons stated above, and with a particular focus on providing opportunities of ownership for people traditionally denied such roles in agriculture. People of color, LGBT folks, women in particular. I think those with disabilities, like on the autism spectrum, should also be included there. The end result will be a group of 75 to 100 producers stewarding land everywhere from the suburbs of the nation's capital to the Virginia Piedmont, each one making a living wage and enjoying a high quality of life, where our customers enjoy greater access to our products in terms of price, variety, availability, so on. They've launched a Kickstarter, so in the meantime, I hope you'll consider making a trip to your local farmer's market. Even in the promised land of farmer-owned brick-and-mortar markets offering door-to-door delivery, farmer's markets will still be one of the best ways to connect to the actual people growing your food and gain an understanding of what it takes to reasonably feed a hungry planet. And that's the thing. If we, as people, want others to be responsible, we may think we're responsible, maybe we actually do many irresponsible things. But let's say you see people acting irresponsibly, littering, as a perennial example. We want people to be more responsible, but we also still can't let go of this rugged individualism. But I'm telling you, and this farmer makes the argument, and half every show I basically do a story like this to ram home the point that if we want others to be responsible and we want ourselves to be responsible, we need to be held accountable. And that requires joining something. Then, Choi, that means being part of something bigger. Any advantages to, say, being in a church usually comes from paying dues to the church, usually in the form of charity, but some of that will then go to the priest. And thus you get a feeling of being part of something bigger. But it's more than a feeling, of course. It is being part of something bigger. You have joined something. With the decline of churches, we modern Americans seek, and of course, ignore this if you are part of a church. But we're not joiners. We're not joining things. We're not being a part of something bigger. Now, activists like myself are, so I like to think I'm pretty well balanced at the moment. Or I'm seeing the throngs of people on social media. They think they're being part of something bigger by being on Twitter or being on social media a lot. But no, they're acting as individuals. It's a big competition. It's chaos. It's not anything bigger at all because there's nothing cooperative about it. It certainly isn't cooperatively owned. It isn't for cooperative benefit, so on, so on. So let's wrap up in the last minute. Go to my Patreon. New episodes posted on the website. That's 3lefts.news, nothing else, 3lefts.news. I'm on Facebook and Twitter. New episodes posted when this live show is edited. Please just share the show and just give it a chance. And please, any feedback, you can contact me via all those places. I'm very available, and I like to be available. And I am, because I put in a minimum amount of labor power into the economy. I put it here into cooperative enterprises like this radio station that I'm using. I put it into the community farm that I volunteer at, and I help wrangle sheep, and so on. And that gives me the connective power to feel like a whole person. So just thinking about transforming yourself and doing individual things, the best thing you can do as a person to change is to join something. Thank you very much. This has been Dan Platt, 3 Left Show.